Welcome everyone to this special episode of An Hour With, where I'm talking with Dr. Katie Sanderson, who works in the ICU unit of a North London hospital. She wanted to talk to me about the campaign that she started called Asks for Masks, a campaign that I'm very, very happy to be associated with. The auction, and we're raising money for PPE for frontline care workers. The auction is open now, and there's a live event on Thursday, the 14th of May, that's this coming Thursday, at 8:15 after the Clap for Carers. You can also follow us on the Asks for Masks YouTube channel. During this podcast, Katie mentions an author. That author that she referenced was Hadiza Hawa Garba. Season 2 of the podcast will return with more episodes next month. Until then, stay safe and stay well, and lots of love. So, I'll start from the beginning, I guess. When did you qualify as a doctor?
So I was late to the game. I qualified as a doctor in 2017.
So you say late to the game. How old were you?
Oh, I don't know. I'm 32 now, so I was 30, maybe. I'd done something else before.
What did you do before? Or could you not talk about it? If it's PR, I'm going to really, really laugh.
I used to work for a publishing company, and before that, I did a history degree. And
so, why? Because people think of medicine as this sort of vocation that you have from birth. So, you the first sentence you're able to say as a child is, "I want to be a doctor." Did you have that and repress it, or did you just not have it until you were in your late 20s?
I was quite sort of shy growing up, and I think it takes some confidence to imagine yourself being a doctor. And there were no sort of doctors in my family, really, didn't really know that many doctors. And I think, it's not something I really imagined myself doing. But when I was at school, I did sort of enjoy science, and I did a very weird combination of A-levels. So I did a Spanish and a history and an economics A-level, and then I did a chemistry A-level, which I did try quite hard to give up, but fortunately they wouldn't let me. And so I did it, and that stood me in very good stead when I decided to go and do medicine. But I think, it took me a while to come to. And then I thought about it a bit more in my 20s. And I suppose I've always been quite concerned with issues of social justice. I thought a bit about becoming a lawyer and doing things to do with legal aid. And then I ended up doing this, and I'm very glad I have.
And I suppose being a doctor is you're on the front line of social justice. Obviously, you know your Hippocratic oath means that you treat everybody fairly and as promptly as possible and without prejudice, and with urgency, which isn't always simpatico with the way that the government treats people, I suppose, whatever government it may be.
Yeah, I think that's true. And it's a strange sort of intersection of different sectors, isn't it? Because one of the things that's frustrating about hospitals and medical care, I suppose, is, it's the thing that's free at the point of entry, and ideally there's sort of few barriers to accessing it, although obviously there are barriers. And I think one of the things that's difficult is things that end up in hospital are often things which probably should have been dealt with in other parts of society. So people with poor housing, people with inadequate care, people with drug dependence, people who drink too much, people who are overweight, lots of these things, sort of, because I think we've underinvested a lot in public health and sort of other areas of life, fall to the NHS in ways that I don't think are a very brilliant allocation of resources, because acute hospitals are not designed to deal with those problems, and there's a poor integration of acute hospitals with a lot of the other sectors dealing with these problems. And one of the things I think many of us feel very inadequate about and feel frustrated about is these patients you see over and over again, and they come in. I saw a woman quite recently, it's very, very sad, who's young, has young children, and who has really, really severe liver disease from drinking, and her drinking is sort of completely secret, and she didn't admit to it at all for a long time. And eventually it sort of emerged. Anyway, I saw her recently again, I've seen her 3 times now, and I can't help her with that. I can help her every time she presents with, terrible decompensated liver disease. But it's frustrating. Not, you know, I can't get to the root of sort of any of her problems. And I think, you know, there are good alcohol services and there are less good alcohol services, but it's, you know, sometimes you're the sort of end point in lots of processes that have gone wrong.
Yes, it's I've thought a lot about society during this time, about how, you know, some of it almost, certainly the social care angle needs to be sort of broken and restarted, really, with sort of a complete integration. Because as you say, a lot of the people that you'll deal with in a clinical setting, people that could have been helped so, I mean, sometimes in some cases, decades earlier on, you know, if somebody has alcohol dependence, it may well have stemmed from something in childhood that made them scared or upset or troubled. And it takes, you know, an early intervention in terms of therapy and associated things to kind of steer them away. By the time you see people, I suppose the mental health aspect so bedded in, it's almost impossible to combat. And it comes now with a sort of serious physical manifestation.
Yeah, and make you feel quite hopeless as a doctor. And, you know, obviously I work in a hospital and in a hospice, but, you know, it's very difficult for GPs who, you know, have limited resources to help with these things. And you know, I think it's could be organised better. It's, yeah. I don't know what you see in your sort of homelessness, but, you know, many of these things start very young. And I think there's different rhetoric in different parts of society, but we seem to be happy to say, with regards to sort of free healthcare at the point of access, that, you know, that's a good thing and that we should be advocating for the most vulnerable people in society. But I think, you know, the most vulnerable people in society seem to get a raw deal in lots of other areas.
Well, way before they turn up at the hospital, way before they turn up at the GPs, I guess. And I think that is something you see in all sorts of situations in society. But whether they're people who are homeless or people who are acutely physically unwell, there's a whole chain of events that have preceded that. Where exactly do you work? You don't have to say the name of the hospital, but in which ward do you work, in which specialism?
So I work in a hospital in North London, and I did my foundation training, which is the first 2 years. And then for the last few months, I've done a job which is split between a hospice and a sort of acute medical job. And then in the last couple of months, I've been working on a COVID ward, because that was where the need was greatest. So I've been working on a ward where we do CPAP, so sort of positive pressure ventilation, for some patients, which is done in some hospitals in high dependence units and intensive cares, and in other hospitals on sort of specialised wards. And then we have some patients who are on oxygen and who have COVID, but aren't as unwell.
And it seems to me sort of your case is very interesting, because you're like a lot of sort of young recruits, new recruits who have had a very unusual fast tracking into emergency medicine, in the sense that in a normal life, you would have perhaps been affiliated to the hospice, but you wouldn't have certainly been in a COVID ward and be dealing with people in extreme life or death situations. Is that fair to say?
I feel quite fortunate, because I suppose I have a real interest in palliative care, and I think that's probably what I'll end up doing. But the skills, so I've worked in two hospices now, and those skills have been incredibly useful in the last few weeks, because, you know, we see many patients who, unfortunately, we're not able to do that much for, and actually making sure that they have the best death they can, and that it's dignified and that it's peaceful and it's comfortable, and working out what's important to them and how you can sort of honour that has been really important. And I think there's a lot of focus on, there's been a huge focus on sort of intensive care and critical care capacity. And that's actually relevant to relatively few people. And although it's wonderful if we can save the lives of those sort of younger people often who are critically ill, you know, the outcomes globally have not been brilliant. You know, in some by some sort of estimations, we think more than half of those patients will die. You know, actually looking after everybody else, looking after people who are ill in the community, who are at home, who are in care homes, and also people who wouldn't benefit from intensive care, is an important thing to talk about and sort of prioritise as well. And it's something I feel very strongly about, particularly looking after people who actually, unfortunately, because we don't have good treatment for this disease, are going to die despite our best efforts. And that's something I suppose I feel quite, well, I feel really strongly about.
How do you give a good death to somebody who is in isolation, somebody who can't feel the touch of their loved one on their arm or their hand or can't hear their voice?
So I think it goes back for me almost to before that. So I think one of the main things, I've had quite interesting conversations about this in the last few weeks. So very early on in this process, I looked after a patient whose family have said they're very happy for me to talk about her. So a patient, it was when it was very, very chaotic, and it became clear that we couldn't have any visitors in the hospital. And this woman had quite severe underlying health problems, and it was very obvious that she wasn't going to survive. And it was the day that sort of more, you know, there was a lot of questions about whether people could visit the hospital or not, and a lot of confusion. And we had a conversation, it was completely harrowing. We had a conversation with her family in a room with on the phone with her on loudspeaker in a different room. And we asked them all what they wanted to do, and sort of had, you know, I think I suppose the main thing is to say, if you don't give people the opportunity to ask whether they're dying or tell them whether they're dying, you can't have any of these conversations. And I think sometimes as doctors and as medical professionals, we're not very good at saying that to people. And I see lots of people where it's clear they're going to die, but actually we keep saying they're having treatment, you know, we're hopeful, even though the outcome is, you know, pretty certain. And anyway, this lady decided, and the family decided, that she actually wanted to go home, and she ended up going home. And there was a huge meltdown in sort of all the, well, I think across London, all the hospital transport services. And after a long delay, they ended up taking her home in the car, knowing that she could potentially die in the car. And she died in her bedroom with her family around. And anyway, her daughter's been in touch with me and has been incredibly generous and, you know, said that that's something that family will always remember. And I was very fortunate because our local sort of palliative care support teams, a nurse who had done a long shift on the day in question, stayed in touch with this family all night, giving them advice, and some district nurses went to see her. But, you know, there are lots of issues to do with PPE and district nurses who would traditionally go to people's houses and give medication if it's needed. You know, it's been logistically very challenging. I then had a conversation, I wrote something about it that was published, and then I had a conversation with my aunt, who said to me, I just want to tell you my view on this. And she said, my mother was told 4 days before she died by a really insensitive doctor that she was going to die. And it was really horrible. It made things much worse. It didn't serve any purpose. She was going to die anyway. And I feel really strongly that that was the wrong thing to do. And obviously, I think the main thing is to have a relationship with patients so that you can start to have a conversation about what they want to know. And some people want to know more than others, and that's absolutely fine. And I'm not saying you should, you know, treat everybody in the same way, but I think you need to be able to start to have those conversations to work out what people want, and that's a sort of important skill for all doctors and healthcare professionals. And I suppose it takes a lot of time, and it's also much easier if you have continuity and you don't have a different person on a shift sort of every single day.
I think at the moment we've never as a society probably been more aware of death, in that there's this stark release every night of statistics.
Yeah.
Of course, those are only statistics that relate to the awfulness of COVID, but nonetheless they put into your mind, sometimes in a rather anxiety-inducing sort of low-level subconscious way, your own fragile sort of existence. And I think it would be a very good time for everybody to sort of think about that, you know, both in planning your own departure, whenever that might be, you know, but also for healthcare professionals. I have to say, you know, having lost a parent and many friends, in the home setting, it seems to be news that's incredibly well managed with a real degree of honesty and understanding. Whereas in, I think in the hospital, more sort of acute setting, I think it can be much more traumatic, because that is, I remember a friend of mine who had a horrific accident and was unconscious at the scene. And I remember going to the hospital in Bristol, and, you know, she was all hooked up to everything and had some heat pads and sensors. And I said, is she going to be able to come out of this coma? And the doctor said, oh, yeah, well, we're working on it. You know, we're all working on it. And her boyfriend said, well, she's got a GS score of 4, so that's good. And I was leaving thinking, I don't know what that is. And a nurse actually came and said, we'll do the best we can for her. And I knew what she meant. And I went home and I looked up the GS score. GCS. And there was absolutely no way she was ever going to come out of that coma. And I think you sort of, I wasn't close family, I was a friend, but
Why do you think it is that we find these conversations so, I don't know, hard to have? Because it's a, you know, it's a source of constant sort of amazement to me.
Well, I think when the news has been given, I've been around some friends who've, and been around when they've received that news in a sort of home setting, and it's been dealt with extraordinarily, because it's like, what decisions do you want to make? Do you want to be here? Do you want to go to a hospice? What do you want? But I think it must be very, very hard for doctors in that clinical setting to do that, because they perhaps don't know the patient as well, or they don't have the time. They might always feel, by dint of the fact they're in a hospital, that they must throw treatments at people.
Yeah.
And also, it's, I suppose, training, you have to be dispassionate, don't you? You can't, I mean, I'd be a terrible doctor. I would just cry and over emote and become so sensitive. I'd be a bloody mess. I mean, there's a degree of, that you need a degree of dispassionate cool, don't you?
I think there's, you encounter areas of medicine where there's almost a sense that death is, you know, a failure of medical care, when actually death is a sort of inevitable consequence of all sorts of disease processes and accidents. And I think sometimes perhaps we don't think about it in quite the right way. But also, it's an interesting thing. I think one thing that's quite revealing of our attitudes towards it as a society is, you know, a lot of hospice care in this country is charitably funded. And I think that's a interesting reflection of the fact that perhaps it hasn't always been thought of as being centrally important.
So the only shared experience other than birth that we all have isn't deemed worthy of centralised funding is sort of interesting in itself. Describe at its worst what the COVID ward was like.
So we had very, very sick patients on CPAP who are, you know, relatively young, sometimes often, in, you know, people in their 40s, 50s, who were just unbelievably sick and sort of unstable. And I think we had a lack of knowledge earlier on about how to manage them, because we'd never managed it before. So lots of these patients develop blood clots in their lungs. Lots of them benefit from being turned and from being on their fronts in terms of their oxygenation. A lot of them, it's very difficult to feed them, because when they don't have this very tight fitting mask on, they can't maintain their oxygen levels. And so that's another difficult thing. And then I suppose the question of these patients, when actually should they have a breathing tube and go to intensive care, is a difficult, you know, I don't think there's necessarily a right answer, although a lot of evidence is emerging. But early on, I think, you know, it was just not clear what the right thing to do was. And it's very hard to want to do by the best by your patients as a team and just not really to have the required information. There's been a lot of collaboration between, you know, hospitals and doctors and intensive care units, and I think these things are becoming clearer, but certainly in the first 2 or 3 weeks, it was really, you know, that was really frightening, sort of wanting to do your best and not necessarily knowing how.
And bearing that you said it was a new, as you say, new disease and no one really knew the best protocols, what was your PPE kit like in the early days?
So we've had very good PPE in the hospital I work in. Although I've never been sort of fit tested for a mask, which seems to be something that's sort of fallen by the wayside in a lot of hospitals. So we have sort of full PPE for seeing patients on CPAP, which is an aerosol generating procedure. And then for the other patients, we have the sort of mandated PPE, which I think is not necessarily very evidence-based or adequate, but that's what the Public Health England guidance is, which is a plastic apron, which looks like sort of half a bin bag, a pair of gloves, and a surgical mask, which there are lots of questions about how effective they are. And I think, you know, it's interesting, we were talking earlier about losing your sense of smell and the fact that that wasn't, you know, clear that that was a symptom of COVID. I think this is no criticism of my hospital, and I think this has been true in all hospitals. You know, it was very difficult to know early on. Lots of these patients are asymptomatic. Lots of patients who we didn't suspect had COVID have turned out to have COVID. The swabs are not completely reliable. You know, it's very difficult to know where to put people to prevent cross-infections, all of these sorts of problems. And so I think the guidance that you wear PPE of some kind to see all patients is when this is a very prevalent problem is really sensible. But, you know, in the early stages, that wasn't the guidance. You know, there is no doubt that healthcare professionals have infected a lot of patients.
And, you said that your hospital was very hot on the PPE and had the supplies. Do you know other doctors in other hospitals who didn't have what they needed in those early days?
Yeah, so I've been working with this Doctors Association UK, which is a great organisation. And one of the things they've done is they've got this app which you can they've used to collect data about PPE. It's only for doctors at the moment, but the submissions are sort of horrifying. And obviously, it's people who want to spend their time, you know, submitting information about PPE, but they can submit PPE. Sort of information, and then they can request PPE. And then we've been working with a couple of organizations who use charitable donations to distribute PPE to the places where we know there's gaps. And there are still huge gaps, and there are gaps in, you know, there are still gaps in intensive care units where, for example, surgeons are being asked to do tracheostomies. You know, I was talking to someone the other day who'd been asked to do a tracheostomy, which is putting a breathing tube through the front of someone's neck, with a, you know, patient's gown, like a fabric gown with some sleeves taped on. And, you know, there is no doubt there are still huge gaps. There's huge gaps in care homes, there's huge gaps in sort of all sorts of community settings. But a lot of the deliveries that they do are actually still to hospitals.
So your push at the moment is to essentially get more PPE, but to drive it to the community setting participants, so that, you know, drivers, care workers, you know, community nurses can have the sort of proper stuff that they need.
Yeah, and I obviously am a healthcare worker and care a lot about my colleagues, but it applies to many areas of life, doesn't it? People who work in transport, people mm-hmm. who work for the postal service. You know, there's a lot of people who've been exposed to a lot of risk. And obviously, I completely understand that it's a pandemic and these things are not available instantly. But I don't think we've acted very quickly or very efficiently to get PPE to where it's needed. And I think it's been a disappointing effort in some ways.
And what do you do with that disappointment? I mean, how do you channel that? As you say, you want to help people, you want to save lives. And when there's the kit that you have is inadequate, well, how does that make you feel?
I suppose I've tried not to be angry all the time and to do things with my free time that are constructive. So I've sort of spoken a reasonable amount on the radio and things about what I see as being the problems, so PPE, but also some of the other problems for healthcare staff that I feel strongly about. So the fact there is no commitment yet to how their deaths are going to be investigated, which I think is quite shocking given the amount of rhetoric around healthcare workers being heroes. There's no commitment to opening inquests into all of their deaths to understand the sort of local circumstances. And there's no commitment to a public inquiry looking at the availability and the policies around PPE. And I think both those things are needed. I suppose the other things I feel strongly about that relate to healthcare workers are there's so many people from abroad working in health services and care. And there's, you know, loads of them have really sort of uncertain visa situations. And, you know, I feel strongly that we're saying these people are heroes, they're, you know, risking their lives to look after the people of this country. I don't think the visa sort of assurances that have been made are very satisfactory. There's been some assurances about visas for, you know, the dependents of people who die, but what about the people who, you know, who don't die? I think they're important too. And then about fees for international medical graduates and various other issues. I think you have to sort of understand that there's a certain amount of antipathy, certainly among doctors, towards the government, because I think people feel that over the last sort of decade or two, doctors have been hung out to dry a bit.
Well, I mean, I think you can say that without it almost being too political a statement. I mean, the economic facts are a matter of public record, are they not? That austerity meant there was less money, and there was less money for hospitals, but almost more acutely, and this goes back to your very first point, you're seeing people who had the money been available 10 years ago may not ever have had a hospital outcome, because the interventions grassroots would have been there to remove alcohol dependency, get some mental health treatments in place. So I'm interested. I mean, I sort of read that, you know, NHS trusts are, I mean, one has to be very sceptical about what you read, but NHS trusts are sort of silencing doctors. They're trying to maintain the sort of wall of sort of no criticism, I suppose, by not allowing people, you know, doctors, nurses, etc., to sort of say how it really is. Do you have any sense of that?
Yeah, so the Doctors Association has done a survey about sort of whistleblowing and speaking up around PPE and around COVID, which is not quite finished, but I think that's in response to the fact that there's many reports of, there's all sorts of things. So there's the idea that people can't speak about what's happening in their trusts. And, you know, one of the things that made me speak out about this in the first place was that I found it hard to convince my family about the sort of dangers and how serious the problem this was. And also, I was going to do an interview, and I was trying to find someone from intensive care to be interviewed with me to talk about the fact that many intensive care, you know, units were under huge strain and struggling with capacity. And it's really, really hard to find people who are willing to talk, because there is a culture of it not going very well for people who do. And
but that's awful. That's
it is awful. And, you know, there's one of the things that's drawn me to working with the Doctors Association and sort of campaigning, which is not something I've ever done about anything in my life, is that I think there's various sort of problems in the NHS and in healthcare that have real sort of ramifications for patient safety. So one of the things, you know, that was important in the Francis inquiry and also in the case of this breast surgeon who's now been imprisoned, is that lots and lots of things that go wrong in medicine, it's clear that people have known about for years. So this surgeon, lots and lots of people were quoted saying, who worked with him or who knew about him locally, saying, I would never have let anyone in my family be treated by him. And how on earth does a situation like that arise? And I think progress is being made, but there's a huge disparity. There's a sort of movement towards speak up guardians and all sorts of things in hospitals. But I think there's a huge disparity between that and the reality. And the reality is what's happened to doctors like Chris Day, who spoke up about the fact that the intensive care he worked in was not safely staffed. And the consequences for him have been absolutely terrible. And the proof is sort of in the pudding. So you can say you have a commitment to protecting whistleblowers, and there's lots of new whistleblower legislation and sort of schemes and things. But the reality is people's behaviour is actually influenced by how whistleblowers are treated by the NHS, by healthcare organisations. And the track record is absolutely terrible. And that is obviously concerning for staff and for doctors, but it's concerning more broadly for patients and for patient safety. And I think it's concerning, really, I'm very interested in whistleblowing and how you encourage people to speak up and how you have sort of systems which encourage that. You know, you look at the inquiries into children who've died and social services that have been sort of high profile in my lifetime, and individuals are always sort of scapegoated and seem to be put forward by the authorities as a sort of lamb to the slaughter to protect the reputation of social services or these organizations. And I think, first of all, that's it's terrible for the individuals involved. It's completely unfair. But the other thing is, it's terrible for society because it means that the problems in those organisations are not addressed and they don't become any more effective at things like protecting children. And I suppose it's something I'm very interested in campaigning about. And one of the things I'm interested in, I don't know if you know about the case of this doctor. Let me just find her name.
While you're doing that, I'll rant about whistleblowing, because in my own profession, obviously there was a sexual predator who, in the form of Jimmy Savile, who was allowed, and he was, it came down to that, he was allowed to predate for decades, and everybody apparently knew. So what is, and the idea that the people that knew who stayed silent thought that was a better line to follow than to protect young and vulnerable people is jaw-dropping. But then I suppose big institutions, and the NHS is one of the biggest, feel that they don't want to encourage any more public scrutiny after a decade or so of carrying the can for austerity and stuff. But it's still an excuse, is it?
But these are our public services, and we should know what happens inside them. And, you know, I think just as an example of how problematic these things are, if people have been able to speak up early on about how bad COVID was, how disastrous it was inside hospitals, how sick people were, how sick the patients they were seeing were, you know, people might have taken it more seriously early on, instead of having this, you know, NHS England decided that there was a sort of, it was a critical, you know, incident or something, and the communications about it would be controlled in a particular way because it was a sort of crisis. I'm afraid I don't know what the terminology is, but I can find it out for you if you want. And that was the sort of policy. And one of those things that I was told in my hospital, you know, is that so that, you know, you don't scare people. Well, I think people should be sort of treated as adults and allowed to make their own decision. And that, you know, in my life, the way I make decisions is by trying to get as much high quality information as possible to base.
Where that comes from is the front line with doctors and nurses treating patients. How does it make you feel every Thursday at 8 o'clock? I mean, I presume you are busy doing medicine, but on the rare occasion when you're not, what kind of emotions does it stir in you? Positive and perhaps negative, when everyone takes to the streets and bangs their saucepans and gives cheer.
So I've only been at home once because I've been at work the rest of the Thursdays. I mean, I found it incredibly humbling and moving. I suppose I just wish people, you know, you said death is our own sort of universal experience. We all want to live long and happy and healthy lives. And I feel perhaps it throws into focus the fact that maybe we should value healthcare a bit more highly than we do sometimes.
Yes, I still bawl my eyes out most of those days, but for that reason, really, it's just like, why didn't we always do this? Why didn't we always exist in a even for a moment in a place of gratitude for the system we have and improve upon it day by day? Most to sort of either taking it for granted, or in some cases just sort of berating it or privatizing it or whatever, you know, taking chunks out of it.
And, you know, doctors are paid obviously more than most healthcare workers, but a lot of changes that have been made. I love being a doctor. I know lots of people who absolutely love being a nurse. I think they're wonderful jobs. I think it's a great privilege. You know, being a nurse, just to decide to train as a nurse or a doctor now, you know, I think many people look at it and think, no thanks, because there's a lot of really undesirable aspects of it. Some of the changes that have been made to sort of nursing bursaries and things, you know, it has made it really quite unattractive. And I think that's something that, you know, could be thought about a lot more. And I suppose the thing I'd say to people is, I'm incredibly glad this is what I've done with my life. And, you know, I think they're really, really wonderful jobs.
But as you say, you have to, some people, the kids now growing up, and for whom their first memory of maybe doctors and nurses might be seeing their parents clapping outside, you know, will get involved in the profession because they too want to be, in quotes, heroes. But for those who are a little bit older, you're right, there has to be, it's almost becoming financially prohibitive, particularly to train to be a nurse. I sort of feel with the Hill Heroes thing, although they, you know, everyone who works in that sector undoubtedly are, it'd be good to just back it up with some solid economic sort of help and to say, if you want to be a hero, we will make sure you don't graduate with X number of thousands of pounds of debt.
Yeah, it's very interesting. Do you ever read the FT?
Well, I'm not a stocks and shares girl, but maybe I should take to it. I don't know.
So I don't know. Some of the coverage of coronavirus has been really brilliant in the FT. And anyway, I was just thinking about this columnist who I think is called Janan Ganesh, who wrote an article a while ago about, you know, basically being a doctor having once been a sort of high status desirable job, and the fact that's been sort of eroded and lost. And I think it's interesting. I suppose the, you know, fortunes of different professions wax and wane, but this does feel like a bit of a, you know, has felt like a bit of a trough in how desirable it is to be a doctor in recent years.
But perhaps a peak of will come again, and, you know, these things kind of rise and fall. But as you say, it's like, I suppose everyone has just taken it for granted for so long. This has brought very sharply into focus that not only are we lucky to have the NHS, but actually we need to pay more attention. Because, I mean, in your estimation, presumably COVID is something that we will have to live with for some time.
It's interesting. I think that's true. And I also think if you look at SARS and various other things, you know, there are likely to be other pandemics potentially of infectious diseases, whether, you know, of respiratory viruses or, you know, it's, yeah, I think it's here to stay, isn't it?
And I guess Emily Maitlis did that incredibly charged, powerful introduction for tonight, you know, because we've said, oh, it affects everybody. But as you pointed out, and she pointed out so eloquently, that to different degrees, you know, it's very different for me with a garden and, you know, in very much one of the fortunate haves. And it is for somebody perhaps down the road in an abusive relationship in a small space with limited resource to getting out and being free. And I sort of think if there's anything good that can come out of this horror, it's really pushing to create change so that disparity is, you know, doesn't exist. And I find it very confusing and difficult, and I'm not an economist and I'm not anything really, but I have really used this time to try and get to know people in my vicinity and the charities that work near me, because that's the only change I'll ever stand a chance of affecting, really.
Yeah, and, you know, something somebody said to me early on in this that really struck me was, you know, maybe we need to get used to sort of making do with less. I think it feels as though we've gone sort of, you know, through the looking glass or down the rabbit hole or something, and we're in this completely unfamiliar landscape. And then at some point, I hope, you know, we'll emerge blinking into the sun. But the thing we will emerge into will not be the thing we lived in before. And no. I suppose for me, you know, I hope everyone is thinking about what sort of world they do want to live in.
But we have now reached a world, and it's the similar world that they live in the States, where, you know, it's, if we're, it's jingoism and populism and it's catchphrases and sloganeering and, you know, get it done and save this, save that, save. And a lot of people, I think, want to look beneath that and go, we have amazing things. We have amazing public services and institutions, and they're really worth saving.
Yeah,
but that doesn't mean they shouldn't be criticised and looked at, and that fault should be, blame should be apportioned if it's appropriate, and lessons learned.
Yeah, and I think one of the things I found a bit sort of disturbing as a theme has been this idea, I suppose, going back to what we were talking about earlier about, you know, not wanting to scare people, this thing about behavioural sciences and basically how you manipulate or influence people's behaviour. And I'm sure there is some value in that and this thing of whatever it's called, the nudge unit and whatever. But there's also a lot that's disturbing about that. And, you know, one of my sisters is a primary school teacher. You know, my hope would be as a society that what you aim to do is to educate people properly such that they are able to live, you know, fulfilling lives, have, you know, enjoyable jobs, be productive, and also assess information to make decisions themselves. And that what you aim to do that rather than aiming to sort of influence their behaviour in all sorts of bizarre and sort of clandestine ways. And although I think it's a very interesting area of science and psychology, and I think it's, you know, valuable in many ways, I think some of the things that have emerged are quite disturbing. Mm. And, you know, I think what people want is to be given high quality information and to be able to make decisions for themselves. And that's certainly what I want.
I don't want to get to a stage where government is a sort of form of centralised gaslighting. You know what I mean? A sort of Orwellian sort of superstate where you're told that black is white and you go, but it isn't. And they go, but it is. Yeah. And then you hear it so many times that you will no longer perceive colour in your own way, but in a way that is told to you. And I don't think we're there yet. Don't get me. But I think you're absolutely right. I think,
yes. And these ludicrous claims, like, you know, about testing numbers, where actually it turns out some of the numbers for tests, you know, nearly 20,000 tests that have just been sent out in the post, and these sort of bizarre calculations. And you think, wouldn't it be so much better to say to people, you know, we've managed to expand this exponentially, it's brilliant, today we did this many, we're still getting better, you know, and just to be truthful and honest about it and to accept things that, you know, have gone brilliantly, and to, you know, praise the people involved and to be honest about the things that haven't gone so brilliantly and to work out what you're going to do about them. But if you're not honest about them, then it's difficult to make much progress, I think, in some senses.
And for me, you know, an extraordinary leadership in these extraordinary times would be somebody going, we are learning all the time. We are doing our very best. For those who have died and to their families, we cannot apologise, unreservedly apologise enough. We will do better. We are doing everything we can. This will never ever happen again. We will double up, we will double down, we will make sure we get what we need. And I instead we get take it on the chin, sock it to a mugger. We're not children, you know, and I don't need to hear about the Second World War.
Yeah, and this rhetoric about, you know, being a fighter, battling things,
yeah,
you know, that's, I don't know, it's, there's a whole, well, all this, you know, there's a whole
rhetoric,
academic discourse around, you know, how we talk about illness, but I think it's very interesting and I don't think that language is very helpful.
Well, I also think, you know, the moment you frame an illness as vicious as this one in the context of a struggle, then the people that who have died are, you know, they've been vanquished, they're the losers, they're weak, they're, you know, you, and as you've seen, you said, you know, in your direct experience, you've had young people, and this disease has taken, however old or young they are, it has taken people before their time. Even if they were 99, 100 years old, if they died from COVID, they died before their time. They died at a time before they would have done had this thing not been around.
It's very interesting. You know, I was talking to somebody the other day who I respect a lot, who said, well, a friend who's an economist has told me, you know, actually, most of the people who've died in this were in the last 3 to 6 months of their life. And so if you look at mortality statistics over a year or 2 years, probably it won't be very different to the last 2 years. And I said, well, first, I mean, I don't know what the statistics are. First of all, that's not my experience, because I've looked after many people who've died well before their time. And the other thing is that that's far, you know, that's all well and good. And I said to him, but what if it was 2 years or 3 years or 5 years before they would otherwise have died? How would you feel? I think this person's in 60s or 70s. How would you feel if, you know, how would you feel if that was you? And he said, well, I wouldn't be so keen on dying, you know, 3 years before my time. And you think, you know, there's all sorts of different ways of thinking about this, aren't there, about economics and the suffering that will be caused by you know, GDP shrinking and debt and borrowing and all of these things. And I know there's lots of considerations, but, you know, I don't want my parents to, you know, die before their time. And
no,
you know,
nobody does.
And so I think I think that's a sort of interesting.
I think there's hard sort of economic arguments being made in the middle of a pandemic always sit very uncomfortably. And, you know, it goes back to how we started, really, is if people only want to look at this pandemic and austerity and everything else, really, that is difficult in society through the prism of economics, then I would say this, you know, the people that come and see you who are morbidly obese or who are addicted or who are self-harming, to have spent money on services that would have got to them sooner would save money. If you're just looking at it, and during that time, they would have been able to have fulfilling jobs, one hopes, to pay their taxes, to contribute in myriad ways. So why does it make any economic sense? Same with mental health. Don't fund mental health. Okay, you've got, you know, say, I don't know the statistics, but swathes of the population taking time off through depression, anxiety. Mm. Just on an economic level, fund these things. And that's why I don't understand economists, because it's always after the horse has bolted. So in this case, after people have died, going, oh, it's okay, because they were no longer productive. What does that mean? These are, I mean, as you say, they're lives and worthy of respect and curiosity. And I'm not actually, although, you know, I am party political, I'm not trying to be party political in any of this, because I think any government would be struggling in this situation. But I think it's the hallmark of a government, how they communicate that to the public and what responsibility they take along the way.
Yeah, I think that's true. And I think having the... being big enough to accept that mistakes have been made is, or that you've made mistakes, is really important in all of life, isn't it?
If you were suddenly made the Director of Public Health England or Prime Minister, what simple things would you put in place for today, but also for the future, to make healthcare provision better for everybody?
Goodness me.
I like to end on just something small scale.
I feel like you should have warned me about that. I suppose in general terms, for healthcare and social work, it's not something I've thought about a huge amount, but I think there's a massive, massive focus. You know, look at the press coverage of coronavirus. There's a massive focus on acute care and, you know, intensive care and hospitals, basically. You know, most people are not in hospital. Most medical care is done by GPs, and most care should be done locally. And I know it's not very glamorous to say you should invest in community services, and, you know, people love the idea of CPR and, you know, whatever. But actually, the way to make people live sort of healthier lives, I think, is to put much more money into general practice, make and integrating all of these things. So district nursing, mental health services. There's so much sort of fragmentation. There's so many different people involved, often who, you know, the communication between them is not very good, between drug and alcohol services, you know, all these things. Actually, I think we should be looking at having really, really strong, well-integrated community services, and far fewer people should be in hospital. And, you know, hospitals are really expensive. And as somebody who works in hospital and loves working in hospital, you know, I wouldn't wish it on my worst enemy being a patient in hospital. You know, it's absolutely hideous. You only want to be in hospital if it's absolutely necessary. And unfortunately, in the good times, we have lots of people in hospital who would be better off elsewhere and there, because there's, you know, all sorts of problems with other things. So I suppose that's what I would say. And, you know, other countries seem to be, there's some very interesting organizations in Holland that have developed really, really strong, very local networks of, you know, multidisciplinary healthcare teams. And I suppose that's something I'm very interested in. I'm incredibly proud to work at North London Hospice, which is a inpatient hospice, but which runs the community teams around it. and is a really good example of something that's kind of well integrated and really well run. And you know, I personally think you want to keep people out of hospital as much as possible and look after them well in their homes. And I think that's what most, you know, that's how most people want to be looked after.
And are things frontline? Do you have available beds at the moment? Do you have, as Matt Hancock's favourite word, capacity?
Well, that's such a sort of misguided, not question, but yes, I mean, there's capacity if you want to go to hospital with coronavirus. If you want to go to hospital to have your cancer treated or diagnosed, you know, that's really problematic at the moment. Mm. You know, huge parts of hospitals are not running and we need to get them back up and running. You know, it depends what you're looking for, doesn't it?
Yeah, no, but that's exactly that one word, capacity, you're right, has started to exclusively mean if you are a COVID patient.
Yeah, it's quite a sort of meaningless word, isn't it? And the other thing is that it's really, you know, hospital beds is a very odd measure. So I think some of the talk about intensive care capacity has been really weird, because I know people working in intensive cares where there's two patients per bed space with, you know, 50 centimetres between them, possibly 60 centimetres between them. And there's one well-trained intensive care nurse per six. And yes, there's lots of staff, but they're not intensive care trained staff, although I'm sure they're now better trained than they were. And, you know, this is not intensive care as we know it. We haven't expanded intensive care like if you went to an intensive care last year. And so I think some of the talk about it is quite misleading. You know, I know Nightingale hasn't, fortunately, the capacity hasn't been needed, but the staffing models there were radically, radically different to how an intensive care would normally be staffed. People who work in intensive care are incredibly highly trained. You can't obviously magic loads of very highly trained people. You can't double the number of very highly trained people overnight, because training takes years. And I think, look, heroic things have been done. There's been, you know, massive, massive change in a very short period of time, and we should credit that. But I think we should also be honest about what we've actually achieved, which is not, you know, an expansion in intensive care as we know it.
So when's your next shift? When are you on next?
I am working on Thursday.
Okay, so what do you do in your free time? What's between now and Thursday? Are you actually going to relax? Are you going to eat? Are you going to sleep? Are you going to just take care of yourself?
No, I'm probably not going to relax, because as you know, I'm organising this auction, which you've very kindly agreed to host.
So tell us about that, what I'll be doing. Go on.
I feel very fortunate about this. I wanted to raise some money for these organisations that we've been working with at the Doctors Association, who are really amazing. So one of them is called Scrub and Facial Protection Hub, and they've done a lot. Yeah. They've done a lot of work. So with 3D printing of visors and people sewing scrubs, and they're doing a brilliant job. And the other one is NHS Hero Support, which is sort of slightly bigger. And what they've done is they've worked a lot in medical sort of logistics. It's a bunch of volunteers, and they've been managing to get hold of PPE from China and getting it to places where there's gaps. And then the other thing is they're involved with various other projects to try to develop washable gowns, for example, that could be used sort of multiple times, and sort of some of the solutions to some of the problems, which ideally wouldn't be endlessly throwing away, you know, huge volumes of stuff. So I wanted to raise some money for them, and I wrote to two people. I wrote to Giles Corran, and I wrote to Sue's agent, whose email address I found on the internet.
I love the fact that you wrote directly to Giles, but that I managed to get hold of
his email address.
Through the gates of Cerberus.
Unfortunately, I never really watch TV, and I don't really know who anybody famous is, and that is somebody I did know who he was, probably because I'm obsessed with going to restaurants. And I wrote
him. These were the two people you'd heard of?
I have heard of other people, but two people who I knew were funny. And so I wrote to these two people, and Giles Corran said he said he wasn't famous enough to host it. So Sue's agent fortunately replied, and Sue
I love
agreed.
The fact we're talking about me as if I'm not here now. Sue's agent. Anyway, I'm going to start referring to myself in the third person, so I'm that grandiose.
Sorry. So Sue very kindly agreed. And so we're hosting an auction and launching a campaign called asks for masks, which was Sue's idea.
Well, it's a sort of loose pun. I think people will know. It has that sort of terrible homespun shitness that people will automatically associate with me. So we are going to be hitting eBay when, remind me, you know I have no capacity for that word again, to remember anything.
So I thought this was going to be a thing which would take me a few hours to organise, which just shows how completely clueless I was. So a huge number of incredibly talented people have been making a website and all sorts of other things. And it's going to launch, so the first auction is going to launch on Thursday after Clap for Carers, and Sue is going to do a live streamed event which closes it on
This is Thursday, the 14th of May.
Yeah, and then there's all sorts of people who've donated all sorts of brilliant things. So you can have a look on the website if you like and see if there's anything you fancy.
And do you have I don't even have the URL for the website. I didn't even know if URL is the right word either.
I'm not the person to ask. So the website, when it launches,
it will either be today or tomorrow.
It's going to be www.askformasks.co.uk.
All right, www.askformasks.co.uk. And there'll be prizes, some sort of big, sort of hefty prizes and experiences that you can bid towards, and then some items that you can just buy outright that won't break the bank. And all that money will go to basically acquiring PPE and getting it to the community settings where it's needed most.
Yeah, or hospitals. And I'd just like to say thank you to Sue, but all the other many, many people who've devoted countless hours to us.
Well, I guess my agent, Debbie, who is monstrous, and I mean that in a loving way, but also still very frightened of her way after 10 years. She's normally just, she's a workaholic, but in lockdown, she suddenly has this window of time, and she's grabbed this with a sort of glee that is very, very impressive. And I'm just very glad. And Giles didn't tell me that he'd put me up for an auction. So basically, you said, can you give a prize? Giles said, yeah, I'll have dinner with Sue. Didn't even tell me. So I've now upped the prize. And I'm not going to tell Giles the added thing, which is that we're both going to have to come in full period costume to a restaurant of your choice, get you drunk, and then Giles is going to write a review of you and the entire evening. So that's just one of the lots. But I will bore people about it on my Twitter feed. Thank you for your time. Thank you for getting me involved in this. It's
thank you.
No, thank you. You know, I'm just a sort of podgy cretin who's been waiting for something to get stuck into during lockdown. So I'm glad to be of any help that I can. And thanks for sharing your time and your experiences and stuff. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you very much.
When the pillars have been restored and the churches there are no more.
That was Dr. Katie Sanderson taking a moment out to talk to me from her rather hectic schedule, as you can imagine. The Ask for Mask website is www.askformasks.co.uk. The auction is open now. Check out the live event on the 14th of May at 8:15 after the Clap for Carers. And you follow us on the Asks for Masks YouTube channel, where I'll be hawking stuff in order to get PPE out to those in the front line who need it most. The author she referenced, if you want to look her up, is Hadiza Hawa Garba. And season 2 of the podcast is going to return with some more episodes next month. I can't wait to be in your ears. Take care.
When the ice cream all runs warm and the music don't play no more, when they run out of lemons to grow, I'll be there if you want me to. When the priests don't believe in a man and the tourists have started to tend.